From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
We're doing a lot today. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Kenyon McDuffie, who is a member of the D.C. Council. Already in studio with us is Todd Turner, who is the chair of the Prince George's County Council. Todd Turner, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be here. Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Danielle Gaines, who is a reporter with Maryland Matters. Danielle, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for having me.
Danielle, before we start directly with you, Tom Sherwood, I wanted to talk about Virginia for a second, because with the repeal of the King's Dominion law, apparently Virginia schools can now start before Labor Day. There were apparently a lot of controversy and a lot of battles over when schools should start. And so it makes significant changes to the so-called King's Dominion law.
Yes, it's been in effect since the 1980s, but just like Maryland, Virginia is loosening up now, and schools will be able to start 2 weeks before Labor Day, but it still will have to have a four-day Labor Day weekend.
What's the situation in Maryland now, Danielle Gaines?
Well, so in Maryland, there was a bill that passed both chambers with a veto-proof majority that would allow schools to set their own school calendars whenever they want. Governor Hogan, of course, had an executive order that would require them to start after Labor Day. But that has gone up for the governor's consideration.
And what do you think the governor's position on it now? Somewhere I heard them say that the governor thinks that local jurisdictions should be able to do this.
So the governor said that if this bill in the General Assembly passed, which would give it back to local control, he would seek legislation that would require a vote before they could do that. So the General Assembly has actually added in the language, if this goes to referendum, for how that would appear on the ballot into the bill. So it's unclear whether or not there'll be a petition to bring this to the ballot or not, but the governor has said that he would be behind that sort of an effort.
Chairman Turner, where do you stand on this?
So I support local control with respect to that. I know I just had recent meetings with our interim CEO at the Prince George's County Public School Systems, and it's been a real struggle over the last couple of years after the governor did his executive order to be able to fit in all that is needed as part of that. The other concern is that with respect to doing a later start time, there's information out there that the longer kids are out of school, the less they recall as part of that process. And traditionally, we started a week or so before the Labor Day weekend. As a kid, I know growing up in New York, we always started after Labor Day, so I know it's close to my heart in that way. But with having a daughter graduate from public schools in Prince George's and having one now, I would like to have that control at the local level.
And Danielle, on the same school issue, there's a big disagreement between the governor and the assembly on how much money to put aside for education, given while everyone waits for the Kerwin report.
Yeah, and there's actually difference within the General Assembly on that as well. So the Kerwin Commission is this group that's been meeting for the last few years. They have big, big visions for how to change Maryland education top to bottom. And at the end of 10 years, they have a plan that would cost an extra $3.8 billion every year. They asked last year for $325 million additional this year. The governor put in about $236 million. The House passed a bill that has $320 million, and the Senate passed a bill that has about $250 million. So that's going to be ironed out in a budget conference committee. The members of that committee were actually being named on the floor as I stepped down to talk to you guys this afternoon. So it's unclear where exactly that will lie. A lot of that is based on whether or not they can find a dedicated revenue stream for that. And revenue means taxes. And so there's going to be a big debate on that.
There are those of us who remember what happened to the Thornton Commission report several years ago. Lack of funding. And I guess that's what the legislature is trying to avoid on this occasion.
Exactly.
What about the $15 minimum wage? The governor has been concerned about imposing that around the state. The House and Senate have come to an agreement that it would go into effect, but businesses with fewer than 15 employees, 15 or fewer, would have an extra year before it goes into effect in 2025.
Yeah, so that bill has now passed. There was a compromise reached between the House and the Senate, and that bill has been sent up to the governor's office. The governor, of course, wanted something different. I think to some degree he saw the writing on the wall that some sort of minimum wage was increase was going to pass. So he proposed a smaller one up to, I think, $12.20 by 2022, and then would have limited Maryland's minimum wage growth based on nearby states. The governor has indicated that he intends to veto this bill. It did pass both chambers with a wide veto-proof majority.
We're talking with Danielle Gain. She's a reporter for the for Maryland Matters about what's going on in the state legislature in Maryland. Joining us in studio now is Todd Turner. He is the chairman of the Prince George's County Council. Danielle, Governor Hogan had some choice, harsh words for the democratically controlled legislator, calling spending plans, quoting here, reckless and unsustainable and irresponsible. He went on to say that if those spending bills passed, it would mean this would be, quoting here, the most harmful General Assembly session ever for Maryland taxpayers. What was he so upset about?
So there is some nuance there. The governor's office had added up the amount of mandated spending in every bill that was introduced this legislative session, and that added up to, you know, an eye-popping figure. But those were sometimes bills that were very similar to one another or bills that stood no chance of passing. So kind of the overall number that he was talking about in that press conference was a little overblown, but he is genuinely concerned about the cost of the Kerwin Commission, especially in light of no changes to revenue, which he, you know, wouldn't support an increase in taxes. He thinks, you know, some of these big money spending ideas that the Democrats have, education and, you know, increasing the minimum wage, are just going to harm Maryland's economic outlook, especially because most economists think, you know, the whole country is due for a recession sometime soon.
If he does run for the Republican nomination, he's going to learn a lot more about overblown. But here's not
and,
sure
and I'm wondering if that, if what the effect, you know, governor has been to Iowa, he's going up to New Hampshire in late April. What is the effect of his at least playing with possibly being a candidate for president? How is that affecting the Democratic legislature? Is the governor posturing with all the things you just said?
I think there have always been attempts, you know, to try to for him to put the legislature in the corner, or the legislature to put him in a corner. I do think the way he speaks has been, you know, a little bit different. That press conference with the overblown spending and the recklessness, you know, there were national reporters in the room, and so I think overall, there's just kind of a little bit of a different vibe, but, you know, he's sticking pretty close to the things that he has advocated for in the past.
Among the quotes was the most pro-criminal group of legislators I've ever seen. Did any of the legislators so accused respond to that?
Oh, absolutely. People were upset about that quote, and, you know, were talking about, you know, trying to make a more just justice system. You know, hunkered down into the positions on the bills that he was referencing in that quote.
Yeah, minimum sentencing is not very popular around the country. Let me ask you about Peter Franchot. He is the most popular politician in the state of Maryland, and probably the least popular politician in Annapolis. But his craft beer bill has gotten through, even though he's getting no credit for it.
Right. So Comptroller Franchot has introduced this legislation, Reform on Tap, for the past couple of years, or he's been working on it for a couple of years. This year, legislative leaders chose not to introduce that measure on his behalf. The various parts of that were broken up into different pieces of legislation that are indeed moving forward. Those bills kind of change the franchise laws, which make it a little bit easier for small brewers to get into and out of contract. It also allows them to sell more on their premises, and it's moving forward. At the same time, actually, is a bill that takes a big part of Comptroller Franchot's office out of his office and will put it under a new commission on alcohol and tobacco.
How do you explain the difference?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of bad blood there at this point. So, you know, Comptroller Franchot is an ally of Governor Hogan on the Board of Public Works. They have criticized the General Assembly on a number of fronts relating to, you know, fiscal conservatism and the school start date issue, you know, heating and air conditioning in schools. And so things have been brewing for a long time between the two sides there. And when the comptroller originally started pursuing this beer legislation, he came at it full force with a message that really resonated with Maryland residents, but attacked lawmakers at the same time. And so things just didn't move forward under his agenda, but rather other people's.
Speaking of not moving forward, legalization of sports betting, recreational cannabis use, why didn't they move forward?
So there's a few reasons. So the recreational cannabis use, they are putting together a group that's going to work over the summer to kind of envision how a legal recreational cannabis program might look in the state of Maryland, to look at what other states have done, and to really kind of just fully envision how that would work and kind of craft legislation that could be passed next year. The same with sports betting. It's new. Maryland is not really getting in on the front end of this, like D.C. and some other places have, but they're going to study it. And both of these items would be going to the ballot, and they wouldn't be going to the ballot until next year anyhow. So there is time to – there's one more session that they could take to figure all this out.
Danielle Gaines, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Danielle Gaines is a reporter with Maryland Matters. Our guest in studio is Todd Turner, chairman of the Prince George's County Council. If you have questions or comments for him, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Email to kojo at wamu.org or call 800-433-8850. Tom, it would appear that it is entirely possible that the Virginia elections expected in June could be affected by the case before the Supreme Court of Virginia redistricting.
Yes, the Supreme Court is hearing this case, and depending whether it supports what the district court did, rewrote the lines for about 11 districts because the state legislature wouldn't do it. Republicans don't want to be forced to do it by the courts. But if the Supreme Court upholds what the district court did, well, they'll just go forward. But if the Supreme Court agrees that the court went too far, in the primary in June will be delayed while they try to sort out where voters will go. And most of these districts are down around the Richmond area, not in Northern Virginia.
And Governor Hogan has called for a state takeover of the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. Todd Turner, did you drive the Baltimore-Washington Parkway?
I have recently, actually, and I agree with the governor in this sense that it definitely needs additional improvements as part of that. I think the concern that we have in Prince George's County, and we did a resolution last year when the governor proposed that the state take over the BW Parkway, not for the intention of doing maintenance, although that probably is part of it as well, but also the pending review of the high-speed maglev train, which has going through an environmental impact statement right now, and the two proposed alternatives are along the BW Parkway. So I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I think that's one of the reasons the governor is calling for the state take over the entire length of that. And so we did a resolution last year to our federal representative saying that we were not supportive if it was for that purpose, for the purposes of the maglev.
It's embarrassing for the Park Service. The
potholes, congestion, yeah. Crashes, debris.
And George Washington Parkway's part of it's closed today because of the same problem.
Exactly right.
But the governor wants it for long term, not just to fix potholes.
No, that's definitely, I think, his intention as part of that. And we should have a conversation about that. I think one of the things that, and obviously this is my second term right now, and now first as chair, the conversation that we've had with the state, particularly the Maryland Department of Transportation before, has been always cordial, and we're part of the process. We go through an annual process of dictating what our transportation priorities are for Prince George's County. Each of the jurisdictions do that in the state. But the communication has been somewhat lacking a little bit recently, obviously with his announcement of the $9 billion expansion of 495, 270, and BW Parkway. I can tell you right now that's not part of our transportation priority process part of that. Not to say that we don't have issues, but it's a situation where we need to speak together to make sure that we're doing stuff that we all can support.
The Purple Line is part of your bailiwick, and it looks like the state can't agree with the contractors for that. It's lots of money, hundreds of millions of dollars behind schedule. There's some doubt that it will open in 2022. This is important to Prince George's County inside the Beltway. What's your concerns there?
Yeah, obviously we share the concerns. We actually just had a briefing a couple of weeks ago in one of our transportation committee with the partner as well as MDOT, MTA as part of that. I understand from their representation to us that, you know, the dispute will be determined underneath the agreement as part of that, that they're trying to, in essence, play catch up. And the reason for the delay, in all honesty, was because of the citizen opposition and the court cases that were done. So that slowed down the process.
We got an email from Jim who says, where does Todd Turner and the council stand on Beltway widening?
We have not taken a formal position on that yet. However, I think that it goes back to that question of having that conversation with the state to see what's appropriate as part of that. There are definitely some concerns and whether or not we have the land around the Beltway to actually expand it. Literally on Monday afternoon, the county council will be getting a briefing from the Maryland Department of Transportation on their managed study, which is for 495 and 270. We requested that last year and we got a nice letter back saying we'll get back to you. So when the Secretary of Transportation came to Prince George's County late last fall, that was an issue of conversation between us. And so they're coming this coming Monday. So
let me get into some Tom Sherwood territory here, because this is your second term on the county council. You have been in politics in the state of Maryland for quite a while. You were the mayor of Bowie at one time.
I wasn't the mayor. I was the mayor pro tem.
Mayor pro tem of Bowie. You mentioned earlier about your growing up in New York. Did you come directly from New York to Prince George's County?
I did. And so I've been here now 18 years. I came in 2001. As Tom was asking me a little bit earlier, the reason for that is because of love. I met my wife up in New York in school. We had our first child, and she grew up here in Maryland, not in Prince George's County, but up in Baltimore County. And so we made a personal decision after years of lobbying for me to join her coming down to Maryland and our family, and it's been probably the best decision I've made.
You know, I called around to ask about you because you're in your second term, and I was very disappointed. Every person I spoke to said, you're such a nice guy.
That'll change after today.
Well, we'll fix that maybe. Okay. But there also one person said, well, you ought to ask him, Tom, if Angela Alsobrooks runs for governor in 3 years, will he be running for county executive?
I will say this. This is a challenging year for Prince George's County and the county council in particular. That's one of the reasons I decided to ask my colleagues to be chair this year. I try to focus on short-term goals as part of that. Obviously, I will start thinking at some point about what I'm going to be doing next as part of that. Obviously, we're trying to develop a good working relationship with Angela Alsobrooks. We're very excited about that.
Have you guys confirmed all of her appointees?
We just confirmed her first appointee this week. We have, I believe, four more coming next week. We did extend the opportunity under the charter to allow them to have a couple more months, as you can see, as part of a transition. And so far, we have confirmed those that have come through the
program. The most controversial one seems to be Melinda Bowling, who is
still acting.
Who is still acting as the Department of Permitting and Inspections. She's the former director of the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs in the district, and her tenure here was fairly controversial. What is your thinking about that appointment right now?
So obviously, I'm old school in this kind of way. I give deference to the executive branch to determine who their director should be, unless there's some really outstanding issue with respect to their qualifications as part of that. We will go through our process. We have those directors come in to our committee and do a public process. They go through a public hearing process as well as individual meetings with council members. I know she has at least come through that as part of that process. She has not been formally submitted to us for the appointment, although we did extend her to give an additional more time for the county executive to submit her name.
Derek Davis has a bill to allow the county executive to collect developer contributions. Still ban the council members. Where are you on that bill?
Obviously, the county council did not take a position on that bill because it does not impact the county council directly.
Where do you stand?
Listen, we just went through last year a really extensive conversation about public financing in Prince George's County. It was a situation where, you know, I didn't necessarily agree that we were ready to do that in Prince George's County, but a majority of the council moved forward. So that will be implemented over the next several years going into the 2026 election. So I think that has to be part of the conversation of any change at the state level. Personally, I feel If that restriction is going to be lifted, it should be lifted for everybody and not just for one particular person. But that will be a decision that the General Assembly will make.
Here is Derek in Bowie, Maryland. Derek, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be able to call into your show, longtime listener and fan. Mr. Chairman, curious about what your position on the project slated for Mount Oak and Church Road. I live in your district, and I live near that particular slated project. And as you know, or you may know, the Bowie Council voted unanimously against that. Your office has not actually laid out what your position is. And constituents, of course, have raised concerns about undue burden to taxpayers and pollution and congestion. So we'd love to hear your perspective, sir.
No, I appreciate that.
What is it?
So let me explain what it is. There's an application pending for a water and sewer change, which is a precursor to development of a site on Mount Oak and Church Road. There's a proposal for, I believe, a 60,000 square foot church that already currently exists in the Bowie area that's looking to grow in that space. And so the water and sewer category was actually just presented to the council this week. It has to go to public hearing, go to committee as part of that process. I've met with the community surrounding that. I've also met with the church itself. The difficulty here is, not to get into the weeds, but a water and sewer category change is not a development. It allows whether or not you can go forward and whether or not you meet the criteria as part of that. So I'm reviewing that now. Obviously, I have not received the correspondence from the city of Bowie, but I know they did discuss it as well. So,
Derek, thank you for your call. Governor Hogan has been pushing for some kind of development at Oxen Cove, the historic farm and parkland northeast of Wilson Bridge. Some people who use that area for hiking and just environmental stuff.
Yeah, there's a working farm there as well. Yep.
What do you think should happen to the site?
Well, the site right now is currently in federal hands. I know earlier this year or late last year, there was a lot of discussion about the use of that site potentially for the football team that we currently have in Prince George's County. Again, this goes back to communication issue. I understand the governor had this communication with the Department of the Interior about potentially doing a land swap with land that the federal government might need in Western Maryland, I believe. But Prince George's County has not been a party to that conversation. I understand since then, Governor Hogan has backed off of that position. We support that. We did obviously speak with our federal representatives about whether it was appropriate for that federal land, which is now open space in that area, whether or not that should be appropriate for development or not. And if it is, what is the process for doing that?
You just said the football team we have in our county. Do you not say the name of the team?
I try not to say the name of the team because I know it is controversial to some.
Do you want it to stay in Prince George's?
I think we're part of that conversation right now. Obviously, we know the lease will expire, in 2027.
What do you think?
Me personally,
yes.
I think we should have that conversation about keeping the team in Prince George's County. If they play a lot better, I think there will be a lot more support for that.
What about making the team, making your condition, whether it changes its name or not?
I'll be honest with you. I think that's part of the conversation that we can have. I mean, I know the district.
This is too many conversations. I want conclusions.
Well, I know my place as chairman. I might have my personal opinion, but
which
I don't speak on behalf of the council
as a
whole.
Speak on your personal. Do you think they ought to change the name?
Yeah, I think they. You know, it's just watching the NCAA tournament the other day. I grew up in New York. Basketball for me was Syracuse and St. John's. St. John's was called the Red Men. They changed their name to the Red Storm, and because of the history, my high school football team was the Curtis High School Warriors as part of that. They have not changed their name, but there was respect with respect to being a warrior as part of that. So I think that's something I personally, not speaking on behalf of the council again, I think that should be part of a conversation if the Redskins, again, using their name, where do you say?
Washington Warriors? Washington Warriors?
I'm a warrior from True and True from my high school
okay.
days. So.
Well, speaking of race issues, last month, Harford County Delegate Mary Ann Lasanti used the N-word to describe a Prince George's County House district. She has since apologized. She's been stripped of her leadership position. She will undergo sensitivity training. How did that incident affect you and your colleagues in Prince George's County?
Obviously, we were very upset about that. Obviously, we joined with County Executive Angela Alsobrooks to denounce the use of the term. We asked for the General Assembly to take action, which they did. We also asked Delegate Lasante to give a personal apology to the residents of Prince George's County, which I believe she might have done. I'm not sure. It's kind of unclear, but I think she should make that effort. I know County Executive Alsobrooks has offered that at some point. It does raise a larger issue about the use of that word in particular. I have a teenage daughter, and I can unfortunately listen to some of her music sometimes. And listen, I grew up back in the 80s. You know, there are certain groups that actually had that name in their title. But I think we should get away from the use of the word, no matter who is saying it. And I think that's the ultimate, ultimate thing that we should try to do, that nobody uses the word, no matter what color, race, or you are.
Tell us about the Prince George's Hospital. You're caught up in the University of Maryland medical system controversy. Where are you on that?
Well, before all this broke, I guess, in the last week or so, our partnership between the state of Maryland, the University of Maryland Medical System, to establish the University Capital Regional Health has been a great thing for Prince George's County as we're continuing to build the new regional medical facility in the Largo area. Obviously, what we saw over the last week is not something that any of us who are in public office and respect the roles that we have should be part of that. I think the state is undertaking, obviously, a review and considering legislation as part of that. I literally say we just formally put a permanent board for the Capital Regional Health in January. And so we've asked our staff to go back to make sure that there aren't those kind of issues with respect to those who have been appointed to serve on that board.
Do you think board members who had deals making money should be off the board?
That's going to be a decision for the state, to be honest with you, because it's a state-supported agency. But yes, basic ethics is part of that. You shouldn't, particularly for a not-for-profit board. I understand if you're in the private sector, obviously that's why you're on the board, is to make money. But in the context of being on a not-for-profit board, you should not have that kind of dealings as part of that. Or if you do, it should go through a very strict process as part of that.
Prince George's County was initially in the running for Amazon's HQ2, didn't make the short list, and apparently Governor Hovind would like to think that Maryland is still in the running, which seems unlikely. Do you think there are ways that Prince George's County can make itself more attractive for large-scale investment and development?
I wholeheartedly
mind what John emails. Why does Prince George's County keep adding more residential when there's an excessive amount of residential compared to business? So
okay.
John apparently wants to see more businesses.
Gotcha. No, I appreciate that, and that's why we've been very supportive under both the new administration and the new county council. We just recently sent a letter between the county executive and the county council to Amazon, saying that Prince George's County is open for business, that we have opportunities, although we were not successful as part of the location of the headquarters itself. We understand the regional benefit that Amazon will have, not only in Northern Virginia District, as well as Maryland, including Prince George's County. And so we look forward to those opportunities. One of the other things that we've completed over the last 2 years, we've done a comprehensive housing strategy process. We just actually received our briefing on the final report earlier this week. And so we're going to talk about that mix. I think it is fair to say that we want to increase the opportunity for commercial development in Prince George's County. That's why we're so supportive both of the Purple Line, as we mentioned before, as well as the new Regional Medical Center, because we know that will increase economic development, particularly along that corridor and in that part of Largo as well. So we're working on it, but we also want to have housing types that meet all the needs of the residents in Prince George's County.
Only about a minute left in this segment, Tom.
Is the Wilson Bridge working?
Yes. The one thing that we continue want to have a conversation, I always appreciate having talks with people. That's a good thing. Obviously, when the Woodrow Wilson Bridge was done, there was a conversation about being allowed to expand Metro over the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. I think that time is right, particularly with the decision by Amazon to be in Northern Virginia, which is just over the border, particularly from Prince George's County, and having transportation access from them and to them. I think that's one of the benefits that we have in Prince George's County with the metro stations that we have. We have easy access both ways to get there. So has been working. It was a good investment. And now we just need to figure out if we can extend metro service as part of that. Because I serve on the Washington Suburban Transit Commission that has, includes the WMATA and the historic deal that came about last year after 40 years for additional funding. Now we need to get it back to being safe, but then to start about expansion as well as we see it with the Silver Line in the Virginia.
Todd Turner, he's the chairman of the Prince George's County Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Next up is Kenyon McDuffie. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 5. Tom Sherwood Cheers at the Big Cheer is closing today. It was a Ward 6, Ward 8 sit-down restaurant that whenever we had an event at the Anacostia Playhouse, I always went to have lunch at Cheers.
A great little spot.
And however, the owner of the spot, Dionne Reeder, you remember she ran for an at-large city council seat, an at-large council seat in the last election. She says she does not want to close. She's trying to negotiate a new lease with her landlord, but the landlord, the Curtis Investment Group, apparently is not cooperating at this time.
Well, and she acknowledges she could do better with that project, but she's not blaming the new busboys and poets down the street.
She said that's bringing in more business.
Actually, it is. I went there when she was running for the large council seat and had a couple of sodas in the afternoon, not beer. It's a nice little place. It's unfortunate if it closes.
It certainly is unfortunate if it closes. We've been joined in studio by Kenyon McDuffie. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 5. What can you do to keep Cheers at Big Cheer open?
We can make sure that we're paying attention to the things that are happening in those small business areas before owners like Dionne and others reach the point where they feel like they need to close. It's one of the reasons why I really, in my capacity as chairman of the Committee on Business and Economic Development, have focused on our small business corridors, in particular making sure that there's resources for women-owned and minority-owned businesses like Dionne's.
Are you, you know, busboys, everyone's very happy it's there. They recognize it can also add to gentrification for that neighborhood, historic Anacostia, but the people are desperate, they really want the people who live there to benefit from it. In your work on the council, have you focused on historic Anacostia? It is in the bullseye of potential gentrification.
Absolutely. It is an issue that is impacting neighborhoods across the District of Columbia, and Anacostia is no exception. In fact, there are a couple of developments that the city is involved in along Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, including some of the development occurring on St. Elizabeth's campus, and working closely with Councilmember Trayon White, as well as Deputy Mayor Brian Kinner, to make sure that development is being done in a way that is more inclusive than it's typically been done in the past. I think that we need to make sure that as we spend government resources to do development projects, that we're doing it in a way that is participatory for the residents who live in those existing communities. We need to focus on housing affordability and inclusivity.
Because just this week, we heard a new report that said that between the years 2000 and 2013, the district lost 20,000 of its low-income residents who could no longer afford to live here. And Mayor Bowser presented her 2020 budget this week, and I suspect that the major issue coming out of that budget is whether or not it caters to more affordable housing here in the District of Columbia. I know, Tom Sherwood, you looked at the budget. Is that the big issue coming out of this budget?
Well, the mayor's put more money. She's been spending $100 million in the Housing Production Trust Fund, and she wants to raise that to $130 million, and she wants to add another $56 million, I think it is, $36 million. All those numbers start running together for homelessness. I don't think on housing, all the activists think the mayor should be doing more. I'd like to hear the council members' view of that. But I think the issue on the budget is going to be, because the chairman this morning, talking to the mayor at the session, which I think the council member just came from, the chairman of the council, Phil Mendelson, is worried that's not enough money in there for the schools. But on housing, Mr. McDuffie?
Yeah, I'll acknowledge that Mayor Bowser has made housing affordability a priority under her administration. She's consistently put $100 million in the Housing Production Trust Fund, which the council has supported, in some cases even increased. This year, she's increased that, as you mentioned, Tom, to $130 million, which is significant. Frankly, more significant
than any city in the country.
Right. But she's also doing $20 million, I believe, for workforce housing, which we have to sort of unwrap and dig into that to see exactly how that's going to be leveraged. But I think there are some challenges. I think when you look at the status of our public housing, the inventory within our housing authority, we've got to do a better job of taking care of that, maintaining that, and providing quality, clean, safe housing for some of our most under-resourced residents.
The City Paper did a big story on the Morgan Baskin, that story on this, that there are thousands of units that are just almost uninhabitable.
Yeah, and it's a shame. I mean, this is public housing that the city has responsibility for, and the city can't be a slumlord when it comes to how we house some of our most vulnerable. And, you know, I've had situations in my own ward, like Montana Terrace, where we've had some significant challenges. I have appreciated the focus that the director has put on it, though. He did an assessment of the entire inventory, noting the significant challenges that he faces, but also noting how much it's going to take to fix this problem. And in the budget that we have before us, there isn't enough investment in that particular housing stock. And I know the federal investment, it seems to go down more and more each year.
Can I just point out, he said sure. The city can't be a slumlord. Very, very strong statement.
It's been a dramatic week in the council. Let's start with Tuesday's unanimous vote to reprimand Councilmember Jack Evans. Some people are suggesting, though, that the council should take further action, including stripping Evans of his chairmanship of the Finance and Revenue Committee, which you sit on. The council chair, Phil Mendelson, said that would be a rush to judgment. You, of course, are a former prosecutor. What are your thoughts on the actions of the council, and should they go farther?
Indeed, I am a former prosecutor, and as a former prosecutor, someone who really holds dear the principle of due process and that a person is innocent until proven guilty, I'm also incredibly frustrated that we find ourselves here again as a council with this type of negative scrutiny on the work that we're doing, and for it to be focused on the longest serving member of the council. It makes it even worse. So this week we voted to discipline Councilmember Evans.
Unanimously discipline
Councilmember Evans. We stripped his committee's oversight of two important agencies, the Commission on Arts and Humanities, as well as Events DC. Both are near and dear to the councilmember, and those are now going to be taken out, and we're going to take up where those get sent. In our next legislative meeting. But we also, the chairman, re-referred several bills that are in his committee, tax abatements, as well as tax increment financing measures out of his committee. And now I have those measures in my committee. And so, listen, you know, the council has to make sure that we always police ourselves. And we've got to hold ourselves to the higher standard of ethics. And it, you know, sometimes I think rings hollow on residents of the District of Columbia when they see this type of thing happening. We got to make sure that we are good stewards of public dollars and give the public every confidence that we're going to make decisions that are in their best interest.
Some council members have suggested that you would be a good choice to be the new chairman of the Finance and Revenue Committee, the committee I think Jack Evans has had for 20 years or something. Would you be willing to take over that post and give up business and economic development?
That's not a decision that I would make on my own. It's a decision that I would make with the chairman of the council and my colleagues. I'm always willing to put the institution first. I'm willing to serve and make sure that those important functions that are in the Committee on Finance and Revenue have strong oversight.
Yep, so yes is the answer, but if the chairman asks you.
At the same time, you're working with Evans on a number of different committees. How do you think these revelations and this vote will affect that working relationship?
Well, I think that the council member is going to continue to do, and I don't want to speak for him, but I know I imagine my colleagues will do everything that we need to do to be great stewards of the city's money and to perform our public oversight function, particularly as we dig into this $15.5 billion budget, to make sure that we're spending money in a way that is efficient and that leaves resources available for the most pressing issue that we face, and that's our schools.
Before we leave, I'd like to get to schools, but let's go back to ethics for one moment. There was another report this week that the Board of Ethics fined Ward 4 council member Brandon Todd $4,000 for making his emails he received in his government office available to a candidate for the school board that he supported.
That candidate did not win.
I don't know if it was the quality of the emails or not, but the fact is some people are thinking this is, on a smaller measure, this is exactly what Jack Evans was accused of, using his government email for some private or personal gain. Brandon Todd used it for a political purpose. Should he be reprimanded?
Well, I think there's been an investigation, there's been a determination made. I think that when you look at all these types of allegations, the reality is if you are a resident of the District of Columbia and you see some of the things that are happening to members of the council, it does further erode the public's trust. And so we have to continuously make sure that we hold ourselves to the highest degree of ethical standards so that we are beyond reproach.
And so the ethics assessment of a $4,000 fine for his campaign to pay, he doesn't personally have to pay it. Do you support a council reprimand just as you did Jack Evans?
Well, I haven't had a chance to read whatever was recommended by Baker. I imagine that it's going to be an issue.
Well, assessed. They didn't recommend. They assessed a $4,000 fine.
And I have not had an opportunity to read the decision, but I'm going to always hold myself and my colleagues accountable because if we don't, then we continue to lose confidence in the public.
And speaking of the Board of Ethics, it's a mess. It's supposed to have 5 members. It's going to soon be down to 2. The mayor has sent over a couple of nominees, which the council hasn't accepted. Are you concerned at all that the Central Ethics Commission agency in the city effectively is not working?
The Board of Ethics and Government Accountability is a very important agency within our government, and they need a full complement of board members in order to function effectively. And I am concerned that they don't currently have a full complement of members, but I also understand some of the concerns that have been raised by the chairman of the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
Right.
Here are some of the concerns of your constituents. Gwen tweets in, what about the businesses closing on 12th Street in Brooklyn? Also, how about that shooting at 20th and Newton? Are things going south in Brooklyn? What are the solutions?
Things aren't going south in Brooklyn. We have a culture of gun violence in the District of Columbia, which has persisted for years, for decades, since I was a kid. And although we don't have the same number of homicides that we had back in the 80s and 90s when we were the murder capital of the country, that culture of gun violence still exists. And, you know, you can support law enforcement as I do and make sure that, and I'll be the first to tell you that we need to enhance our community policing in areas like Brooklyn and throughout Ward 5 and throughout the District of Columbia to make sure that the visibility is there, that officers are engaging the residents where they are. But you cannot police your way out of a problem where young men and women, primarily young black men, are carrying guns and using them to resolve disputes. It is outrageous, it is disappointing, and it's incredibly sad that these young men are doing the types of things that they're doing. This was 6 p.m. on broad daylight on a Saturday.
Kate in Brooklyn says, I've lived and worked in Bloomingdale for over 11 years, had my kids there, and my partner has a small business there. The neighborhood violence is much worse this year than even last year. But her key question and the one we have for you is, what are you doing to help?
Oh, I'm doing a lot to help. And if you're familiar, Kate, with the NARAC, the Neighborhood Engagement Achieved Results Act, it was a bill that ushered in a health-based approach to crime prevention and intervention, recognizing that we've got to get to the root causes of this violence, of the gun violence, in order to address it more systemically. While law enforcement is doing increased patrols in areas like Bloomingdale and Hanover Place and Woodridge and Langdon Park, where we're seeing some of the uptick in gun violence, we also are putting violence interrupters in place in neighborhoods like Trinidad, which historically has seen high numbers of violent crime. And we have not seen the same level of violent crime in Trinidad over the past year since we've had violence interrupters on Kill the Streets in those neighborhoods, on those blocks, wearing yellow shirts, engaging, squashing beefs, doing the work in the trenches to help solve these gun disputes that we're seeing play out in neighborhoods across the District of Columbia. We need more resources for those programs. And the mayor's budget does include some additional resources for the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement. Attorney General Racine, Mayor Bowser, the council has committed to the NARAC's cure violence approach, and we need to ramp up those efforts so they're in more neighborhoods across Ward 5 and the District of Columbia.
We've talked about gentrification as both a good thing and a concerning thing for those who have lived here and are being pushed out. But, you know, is there any concern that, you know, Brooklyn has had a lot of gentrification or economic development in terms of people moving there? Are you concerned at all that even in Columbia Heights, the other night at Kojo's program, there was talk about Columbia Heights stores are closing on 14th Street and the whole Gala Theater audience is changing. Are you concerned at all that maybe the growth of the city is slowing?
I'm deeply concerned. Pick your neighborhood, whether it's Columbia Heights or Mount Pleasant, where Hella's Bakery used to be, is my mom's favorite bakery. We always got our baked goods from there, whether it is Eckington, Brookland, Trinidad, or pick your neighborhood. There are levels of gentrification and displacement that have occurred over the years. Kojo referenced the recent report that said that 20,000 residents have been displaced since 2000. And it's heart-wrenching when you think about it. And I am concerned about it, which is why I have championed issues around racial equity, social justice, and economic inclusion.
Let me ask about that.
You propose creating a racial equity tool for the D.C. government to use in shaping annual performance plans. First, what's the tool? And second, how would a racial equity lens apply to something like transportation?
So the tool is something that's being implemented in cities around the country, and the council has embraced racial equity in such a form that we've actually become a member of the Government Alliance on Race and Equity. And the tool essentially says that we need to look at how we govern, how we legislate, our policymaking projects through the lens of racial equity, how the decisions that we make as a government impact individuals and groups based on race and other ethnicities. And it's very important as we think about the future economic growth of the District of Columbia, so we don't have the next 15 years from now saying that we've displaced 20,000 more residents. And the tool would be used in any sector that you think about, whether it's education, whether it is housing, whether it is employment or transportation. I think looking at transportation to make sure that people in neighborhoods that have historically been under-resourced have access to multiple modes of transportation to get them to job hubs so they can compete for employment.
I went to your racial equity forum in January at the St. East campus, and you have legislation that would, as I understand, would require for every government action that there be a consideration of what impact it might have racially on the people who live in this city or work in this city. Where is that legislation?
I introduced that legislation in January. It's called the Racial Equity Achieved Results Act. And as you said, Tom, it would do just that. It would require the government to train its employees on racial equity. It would require that we measure performance across agencies through a racial equity lens. And I'm planning on amending it once we have the hearing. And Councilmember Brandon Todd has already noticed the hearing for April of this year. And my plan is to make sure that the bill includes a racial equity impact statement for every piece of legislation that gets passed at the council, the idea being that we look at the work in everything that we do, because here's the reality. If you look at education and the fact that black students average almost five grade levels behind white students in D.C. public schools, the fact that white students are 1.5 times likely to be enrolled in at least one AP class as black students, the fact that there are gaps in educational achievement, gaps in employment, gaps in health outcomes, gaps in incarceration rates. And the one common theme that weaves them all together is race.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're running out of time very quickly, but one part of Mayor Bowser's budget release this week is something you requested, $35 million spread over 6 years to acquire the Wendy's at the intersection known as Dave Thomas Circle. What do you want to see happen at that site, which many obviously feel is a traffic nightmare?
I want to see the mayor negotiate with the property owner, hopefully to purchase the property and to have it redesigned in a way that's safer and more efficient for pedestrians and drivers, and particularly those students who have to traverse that very dangerous intersection at Florida Avenue and New York Avenue. I mean, it is a nightmare, particularly trying to get east and west along that corridor. And if you know anything about it, you likely try to avoid it, as I do, rather than get hung up in that area. And so I'm really happy and that the mayor has included the $35 million in the budget and look forward to having DDOT implement some long-standing solutions to that area.
I mentioned the chairman of the council is concerned that there's not enough focus on education. It certainly is a racial equity thing, that some of the schools in the city like Ballou and H.D. Woodson are losing students and therefore losing money, when in fact more money should be put into those schools in order to attract students to them.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And let me be clear. When I talk about racial equity and economic inclusion, I'm not talking about creating winners and losers here, right? You don't have to take from Ward 3 to give to Ward 8 or take from Ward 2 to give to Ward 7. You just have to look at our $15.5 billion budget to make sure that we are utilizing all the resources that we have at our disposal to give everybody what they need to be successful and to thrive. So if students at Ballou need certain things, they should be able to get those within our budget framework. If you need your potholes filled and your trash picked up on time, you should be able to get the services delivered in a way that is efficient and routine. And I think that we can do that in the District of Columbia government, but we have to be more intentional and recognize that housing affordability is a real serious issue, and primarily because of historic discrimination and policies that were promoted by the federal and local governments across this country.
Let me just ask you one quick question that involves Virginia, and that's your long-term, your friendship with Justin Fairfax, the lieutenant governor. You grew up with him. You've said to me that you're like buddy brothers. You grew up in Washington. How is he doing? It's very serious issue with him, of course, that he's facing in Virginia. Have you talked to him? How is he doing?
So as you mentioned, Justin is one of my best friends.
You only got about 25 seconds.
And I'll just say this. When it comes to politics and the public service, he is one of the most dedicated public servants you'll ever meet. I trust him with everything beyond measure. And I'm really sad for his family, as well as those folks who have made the allegations. And I hope that we get this resolved as quickly as possible.
We'll have to see how this unfolds. Kenyon McDuffie is a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 5. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
Last week on the Politics Hour, Virginia Delegate Kay Corey joined us in studio. We received a phone call from a listener named Josh, who asked the delegate a question about her record on environmental issues. Tom took the opportunity to bring up her opponent in the Democratic primary, Andres Jimenez, who has been talking about environmental issues in his campaign, and Delegate Corey said that's him, referring to the caller. Tom asked if the caller was indeed Andres Jimenez, and when he said no, I said, your opponent says you sound like him, but that was not him. Andres Jimenez called us to correct the record, but we were at the end of the show and could not get him on the air. We apologize to both Andres Jimenez and listener Josh for the misidentification. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunnery, and if you missed our most recent Kojo Roadshow on how gentrification is affecting the arts here in our region, you can find the show we broadcast yesterday at kojoshow.org. Coming up Monday, we'll meet food entrepreneurs bringing their families' food traditions to a wider audience. That all starts Monday at noon. Tom Sherrod, big plans this weekend?
Just to enjoy the weekend.
Wow, that's the biggest plan you've ever announced on this broadcast.
Well, I'm going to some hoity-toity cultural music thing, but I don't want to bring it up.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Margaret Barthel. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schrobstorff, and our senior producer is Mana Kashvi. Our intern is Sydney Grannon, and our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.